Would you pray with me? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Please have a seat. So it was about 2 years ago that I was scrolling through my Instagram feed, and I saw this: the full belly will not find God. If you've ever been on Instagram, you know that you are scrolling through a series of pictures posted by people online, a veritable highlight reel of their lives. The best sights they've seen, the best friends they have, the best food they've eaten. And all of a sudden, all of that was interrupted for me, that parade of highlights, by a friend of mine that I had not known to be particularly religious, who had snapped a picture of some writing scrawled on a wall that said, "The full belly will not find God." When we catch up with our Apostle Paul today, he also is skeptical of the belly. And it has everything to do with God. Paul is writing his letter to the Philippians, and of all of his letters, so many of them so tortured and impassioned, this is the letter that is sunniest. The Philippians are his crown and his joy, he says. When Paul came there preaching, establishing early church community after community, the Philippians welcomed him with open arms, and they took to heart the message about the one about whom Paul spoke. And when Paul moved on from there and found himself thrown in prison by authorities who were threatened by that same good news, it was the Philippians who sent him food and clothing and company. And Paul writes to thank them for their self-expenditure on his behalf. But late in the letter, a letter that has been so sunny, of which joy is one of the watchwords, there are these three lines over which a cloud rolls. And we see the tears well up in Paul's eyes as he speaks about the enemies of the cross of Christ. Their end is destruction, Paul says in lament. Their God is the belly. It'd be possible to misunderstand Paul to mean that the body is bad, and some people have. But in what follows, Paul tells us that God has a glorious future in store for the human body. So that is not Paul's problem. Paul's problem with the belly is not that it's part of the body. Paul's problem with the belly is that it is a great tutor and a terrible master. Because if you listen to the rumbling of your stomach day after day, you can learn that you are a creature whose entire life depends on sustenance coming from outside of you day after day, that you cannot keep life in you. It leaks out of you and one day will completely. But if you let your belly take the reins, then it will control you with the fear of being anything except full, says Paul. And we know this, the way that desire multiplies want, multiplies further need. When the God is the belly, then religion is consumption. When God is the belly, then religion is consumption. And the one thing you cannot afford is to let the emptiness catch up with you. And so you must fill your eyes and your ears and your bank account and your schedule, lest you find that you are empty. And the reason that this grieves Paul so is that Paul sees such a different relationship to emptiness in an old Christian hymn that he had quoted only a chapter ago. Paul talked about the God that we have come to know in Jesus Christ, who, though he was in the form of God, did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, as if his life depended upon it, but took on the form of a slave and became one of us and emptied himself and did not make himself an enemy of the cross and of the pouring out of life, but befriended the cross. We catch up with that Jesus in Galilee or Perea, one of the areas under Herod's authority in our gospel reading from the Gospel of Luke. Jesus is somewhere now between those 40 days in the wilderness when he emptied his belly and his final trip to Jerusalem where he will pour out his life. And the Pharisees that we are so used to seeing as the enemies of Jesus come trying to help him save his skin. Herod is talking about having your head like he had John the Baptist's. You have to get out of here. Jesus does not pack his bags. He looks back at them and he says, "How about you take a message for me back to that fox who fancies himself a lion or a wolf, but is only a minor predator in this food chain? How about you tell him that I'm going to take my time, thank you very much. I have healings to do. I have demons to cast out. I have life to spend on others. But I'll tell you what, you can tell him that if he wants to see me dead, he can just meet me in Jerusalem. Because that's where all the prophets go to die, actually." At the mention of Jerusalem, Jesus' tone goes from defiant to lamentable. His eyes rim with tears, and he looks down south toward Jerusalem, over the hills that separate him from it, knowing he will go there, and he says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that stones those that are sent to it and has killed God's prophets. How often I've longed to take you under my wings, like a mother hen gathers her chicks to shelter them from whatever is threatening. But you are not willing, and you haven't been willing. And I'm worried that all you have in store to look forward now to is vacancy." And there are two things to note here, I think. The first is this. That there is something in Jesus' lament that is much longer than his 30 years. There is an ancient pain that's coming to expression in these few words of Jesus. In the Gospel of Luke, we have only seen Jesus make one trip to Jerusalem, and it's when he was 12 years old, and his parents lost him for a bit and had to come and drag him out of the temple. And so I don't think that Jesus is talking about all of the times in his short 30 years that he has called Jerusalem to come and find shelter in him. He is talking about all the times that he has asked Jerusalem and the people of Israel to do that for the last 2,000 years of the life that he has lived with them as the God of Israel. And he is lamenting that they seem stuck at an impasse with a covenant broken and breaking. But here too, Jesus does not do what we might expect him to do. Just as he does not run away from Galilee for fear of death when Herod comes calling, he does not divert his course from Jerusalem, even if it means certain death. Because something in Jesus has made him willing to be empty for the sake of his people. And that something, I think, is the memory of a very old promise which we hear about in the book of Genesis. At the very beginning of the nation of Israel, we have Abraham, who's been given this promise from God, promise of an impossible child to come from this old man and his wife, Sarah, promise of a nation that would spring from them, a nation on whom the life of the world would depend, that they would be the blessing that would go out to the nations. And when we meet Abraham in that story, the first thing he is told as God comes to him in a dream is, "Do not be afraid," because Abraham is. He has been sitting on this promise, and he does not know what it would take for it to come true. So God takes him out in this dream and shows him a sky, a night sky splattered with descendants. And Abraham nods. And God shows him the land that's in front of him and says, "This all will be yours too, I will make a place and a home and we will share it together. And Abraham can't help but say, how can I know that? How can I know that? And God does not rebuke Abraham for his lack of faith or anything like that. God gives him a grocery list. Go and find 3 heifers, 3 goats, 3 rams, a dove and a pigeon. And Abraham does, and somehow he knows what to do with them already. He gathers these animals and he carves in two each of the 9 creatures and puts a bird and a bird on either side and makes an aisle of blood. And if we read the book of Jeremiah in the 34th chapter, you can go look for it for yourself, or other ancient Near Eastern texts, we find out that this is one of the ways that you would make a very serious covenant in the ancient Near East. You would spell out the terms and conditions in flesh and blood and bone. And the idea is that 2 members of a covenant would walk through the corridor between the halves of animals, making promises to each other, so that if either party breaks those promises, they will bear the fate of the animals they walk between. Not so much until death us do part as death if I do part. Abraham arranges the ceremony and waits. And when it is dark and he has frightened off vultures and carrion birds, something strange happens. He sees a fire pot, which is a clay bread oven, and a torch appear. He receives no invitation to walk down the aisle. And that oven and that torch go by themselves. And this riddle of a promise is dark, but I also think it is clear. And I think Abraham knows what this means. The promises that he has made with God will be kept by that God come hell or high water on pain of death. But not a death that Abraham or his descendants will be forced to suffer, but the God alone. This God is willing to commit himself, come what may, to making good on these promises, no matter what it costs. No matter what it costs. The season of Lent and the table behind me is about what it costs. It's about how far God was willing to go. Here we meet not the God of the belly who demands life at the full, life to the full at whatever the cost, but the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Israel and of the church, the God of God help us, you and me, who is willing to be emptied and willing to pour out life so that others may have it, and who will not keep that life to himself. The full belly will not find this God. But if we come knowing that we are empty, that we are dust and to dust we shall return, and if we are hungry this morning, then it is the life of that God that is offered to us. It is the love of the God that God that is offered to us. In the hope not only of being with us, but of teaching us to be those who will pour ourselves out for others and are willing to love whatever the cost. Amen.